Welcome to The Third Story. I'm Leo Sidran. Today, a conversation with Sophia Rey. Sophia is an Argentine singer, composer, producer, and teacher who has lived in New York for more than 20 years. And somehow, despite the fact that we have all kinds of friends and collaborators in common, we had never actually met before this conversation. I had seen her perform over the years, and I knew her primarily as this incredibly accomplished singer, somebody with serious classical training who had come through the New England Conservatory, immersed herself in jazz, and found a way to bring all of that together with the traditional music of Argentina and greater South America. But what I understood less about her was how interested she is in sound itself, electronic music, production, looping, effects, and this idea she calls folk and futurism. Her new album, Antonima, takes that idea even further. It's a record built around collaborations with women from across Latin America, and it brings together a lot of the different strands of her musical life. What I loved about this conversation is that we ended up talking about more than just her record. We talked about leaving home and rediscovering it from a distance, about technology and tradition, teaching and learning, the strange economics of being an independent artist, and what it means to build a creative life over decades rather than chasing a single moment. Third-story.com is the place to visit the archive. It's hundreds of deep dives like this one, including some of Sophia's friends, collaborators, and contemporaries like Alexis Cuadrado, Camila Meza, Roxana Ahmed, so many. Visit the Substack, leosidran.substack.com, for my latest writings and musings. It's not just episodes, but also commentaries and dispatches from along the way. And remember that we are made in partnership with WBGO Studios. Visit wbgo.org/studios for all of their award-winning content. Here's me and Sophia Rey talking it down.
Yes, check. Sounds good.
That you are a singer and a producer, because the first thing that you did was position the mic correctly, which it's amazing how many people don't do that.
That's true. I know that. I have seen it myself multiple times. Yeah.
As we were mentioning Sophia Rey as you walked in, it's incredible that we don't know each other. We have so many friends in common.
It's crazy.
You know, you moved here, I think, in 2005.
That's
around
right.
Then. Same as me. But I think the first time I saw you, you had been here much longer than it should have been for me to see you. But it was with Ryan Keberly.
Oh, wow.
And I think you were subbing for Camila Meza.
That's very right. I remember that gig
very well.
Cornelia Street. With Jorge Roder.
Exactly.
Yes.
Who's a longtime
collaborator of mine.
Yours.
Yeah.
And so what I sort of understood about you at that moment was that you were like a very accomplished technical singer. That's the first thing I saw about you. That's complicated music to walk in and read.
I struggled with Ryan's music. Let's put it that way.
But it was very impressive. The first thing I saw about you was your, you know, your education.
Right.
I made some assumptions about you based on seeing that.
What did you think?
Well, I thought, okay, this is somebody who has a lot of training and who also is in touch with classical and folkloric traditions and is a jazz singer.
That's right.
Those are all, I think, accurate
That's
assumptions.
Very accurate, yes.
The piece of it that I didn't know just from seeing that was your deep interest in modern sounds, what you refer to as folk and futurism. Your, I think, love of pop music also.
Yes.
And desire to be really a contemporary artist in the sense that the music that you make signals that it's from today.
That's really accurate, actually. And I think it started to be, I started developing more of that side and being more interested in the sonic aspect of music and using those tools to create my own songs and my own productions when we started working on a previous album of mine called Umbral.
Yeah.
I've been working for many years with JC Maylard, who produced Umbral, and he's like, you owe to yourself to do this kind of record. I'm going to help you out. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. Let's go for it. It's very right. I started in music, in the classical music world. When I was a kid, my first professional gig was singing at the Opera House Children's Choir back home in Buenos Aires at the Teatro Colón Children's Choir. At the time, I wanted to be an opera singer. Mm. I followed that path for quite a while and realized, okay, that's not me. Discovered jazz along the way and improvisation, became really, really interested in developing those skills. And that's the reason why I moved to the US.
Yes.
Along the way, I reconnected with traditional music from Argentina that I grew up listening to, not yes. singing it so much, singing at home yeah. like anybody else. But I got really into it, and South American music in particular became something that was very important to part of the music that I was creating. And the sonic aspect again became more of a thing later on. And now I think in this last album, it became even a bigger
yeah.
thing.
You know, I don't think you are alone in experiencing this sense of reconnection with the folk roots of where you came from after you leave.
100%. I've seen it with so many colleagues yeah. and friends of mine, and I've experienced it very vividly. I really feel the soul of my music is there.
Yes. But you're not physically there. And
I'm not physically there.
Do you ever think about being there?
I go back and I reconnect, and I really want to see also what's happening in the scene, in the folk music scene,
yeah.
and what's happening. There are some kids in Argentina that are doing Milo Jota. Have you heard
Mm-mm.
him? Oh, Leo, you're going to love
okay.
this kid. And he is the first, one of the first people that I can think of that's doing that, that's
yeah.
bringing folk music to pop.
Yeah.
In such an innovative way, and sonically, and in terms of the production of his latest album, phenomenal.
Niño, haz las paces con la vida. No es de piedra el pastizal. La nostalgia de tu antes no te deja caminar. ¿Quién mató tu sonrisita de ilusión y de bondad? Sé que te querés dormir para no volver a despertar.
The music that you make reminds me of some of my favorite Latin alternative and electronic music from when I was first getting into it, like 20 years ago. Like these bands that were
right?
playing with modernism and folk music.
It's interesting because my background definitely doesn't describe what I'm doing right
yeah.
now, but this folk and futurism
yeah.
concept started to be like the easiest way I found to sort of describe the connection between also electronic music, because a lot of what we are doing
yes.
is electronic music, even though we are also using traditional instruments, the core of the production is electronic.
Yeah.
And this concept of, okay, moving folklore into a new direction, sonically especially. But I think there was a wave of artists in the early 2000s, in South America in particular, that were really pushing the envelope with all of that.
Yes.
Bands like Don Olek in Argentina. So many artists in Colombia, same thing. A lot of people that were raised in cities and listening to pop and electronic
yeah.
music and contemporary pop genres of all kinds got their eye back in traditions of folkloric traditions back home and turned to see what was the source of that, got the elements, the main elements of that, learned how to play bombo really well,
yeah.
or learned the styles. And in the case of Argentine music, okay, chacarera, samba, all this stuff. And then found a way to bring it all together with a really interesting production
yeah.
style that still La Charo, who's now a guest of my album.
Uh-huh.
I was so happy that she was able to do it. And Gaby Kerpel, so many people that were like reinventing all
Who
this.
Who is Gaby Kerpel?
Gaby Kerpel is a musician from Argentina. He's a really great producer who works quite a lot in that field
yeah.
of electronic meets folk.
Because I knew
meets.
Aníbal Kerpel, who works with Gustavo Santaolalla, but it's the same last name.
I wonder if they're related.
Related. That's why I'm asking. Now we have to do Google.
Google.
Yep, Google, help us. So you mentioned La Charo. That's one of many collaborators on this record. Part of the sort of quiet insistence of this record is that you wanted to connect with mainly female singing partners from all over Latin America.
That's right. What happened is that I teach at NYU in a program called the Clive Davis Institute. And I started teaching, I built my own class of contemporary Latin American music. I felt that it was a good way to share what was happening.
Yeah.
And I started building playlists for my students. And one of them was like contemporary voices of Latin America, something like that. And I started adding and adding and adding songs. And one day I looked and they were all women. And I'm like, wow, my favorite artists are women that are totally like doing something unique, out of the box, most of them independent artists that were really trying to find their own thing in combinations of all these elements that we're talking about. Some of them more towards the R&B stuff or more electronic or more synth pop stuff. But everybody was navigating these waters. And I'm like, wow, I should do something with them because we are searching in different ways. We're searching in a similar direction. Lasañez in Colombia, who I've collaborated with them before, and I felt they were like my twin sisters from another mother, Colombian mother. And Mireya Ramos, Mariana Baraj, who was like an early discovery of folk artists back home that were also doing something very unique with percussion and vocals. Ayer encontré siete lirios que a tu corazón delatan, rebalsando del jarrón, a mí me desatan. Mañana por la mañanita la copla despertó. Enamorada y eterna, sin pesar ni soledad. Juana Luna, who's here in New York. Gestos raros, pocas flores, el recuerdo convenido y la decisión de ser siempre disidente. El deseo del regreso, lo anulado del olvido y toda espiral se recrea. I honestly want to do 10 more like this because I have so many wonderful women artists that are just really doing spectacular work, but we got these 10 songs.
I have no Latino background, Hispanic background of any kind. I'm just kind of a fascinated traveler through this world. But one of the things that I've always been curious about is the experience of growing up in two places like Argentina and Cuba or Colombia and Guatemala is very different. These are very different cultural realities and economic realities and societal and political realities united through language and a colonial history. So I'm curious what you feel is the connecting thread through all of this. I mean, once you're in the exterior, once you're in the United States, you all become Latina.
That's right.
But it's a very diverse set of experiences, and yet you find some commonality through all of this.
It's very true. Each country and even each region, and even within a region, you can find so many different accents and ways of life and foods. Like my first cultural shock was like, oh, wait, I am a Latina here, but I don't eat rice and beans.
Yeah.
And we drink mate. And I think the culture of the south of South America is more similar, like Uruguay and Argentina and Chile and maybe like there are some even in words in the way that we describe fruit and talk about whatever. There are more words in common and there are more things in common. But I guess the commonality is, as you said, the colonial experience, the different ways in which three big groups of population came together and were able to create something together in terms of music, the European traditions, the Afro traditions that came to Latin America through the slave trade and the indigenous populations, how the dialogue between the three groups was generated. I think that created very specific and very interesting, different kinds of cultural types and music, of course. I think that's one thing that we do have in common. And of course, the language, Spanish.
Yeah.
But with Laime, for instance, in this song, it was very interesting because I gave each and one of these collaborators the chance of writing and producing with me or just singing in a song. And I was like, go as far as you can or as you are willing to. And some of them decided they would prefer for me to give them the material. And Daimé was like, let's do it. We got together in Miami in a hotel room because both had to be there for a conference. And I brought to her another song on the record that I was already shaping on my own, Marciana. And I showed it to her and she's like, this is great, but I don't see myself in there. You already have the song. You're done with this.
Yeah.
And I'm like, and she's, do you have something else? Maybe like a sketch of something? And I thought, well, I have a couple of things. And and I showed her something that I started that was very popish to me and in English, which is not very common for me to write in English, but every once in a while. And I was like, I don't think she would connect with this. And she was like, this is it. This is, 100%. And immediately she created this other vocal for,
yes,
for the beginning. And then we went into this Afro-Cuban Orisha chant,
yes,
that brought Oya and... It was so, so easy to build something together. I was pretty amazed myself how it all worked out. And it's, I think, is a good example on how two people that have such different backgrounds. She grew up in a doing rumba, performing in a family that was very rooted in this tradition. But still, we can find a way to connect musically. And that was a beautiful moment.
You are connected through a common language, which maybe makes it, or a version of the same language, which makes it easier to communicate. But what part of what I'm hearing you say is maybe part of what connects you is that you are women artists that share that aspect of common experience also, just to be an independent female artist who has had to find your way.
100%. When we started talking about getting together and doing this, I met her in a random circumstance and I was like, listen, I'm putting together this record. I love your music. I would love for you to be part of it. And we started talking on the phone.
Yeah.
And it was great. I had the best conversations with Daimé. It was like, we were talking about the industry. We were talking about men. We were talking how hard it was to be an independent artist and a female independent artist. And it was so wonderful to share these experiences. It felt less lonely. It felt, okay, there are a lot of things that are happening to me. They're not just to me. It's just how things are built, how the ecosystem works. And those conversations happened with so many of the women that were part of this record. It was one of the most beautiful experiences of it to find that we all share so much more than we think we do. It was a beautiful thing to realize that.
I was listening to this morning to the album and the song that you made with Gaby Moreno, Rótulo.
Rótulo.
Conéctate con tu yo superior.
Buried at the end of that song is a series of kind of parody phrases, like joking about those kinds of self-help expressions that people give you. You'll remember what they are better than
I will.
And they're sort of like joking. And then there's one phrase that you say. I mean, all of them have some kernel of truth in them. But there was one that is, the key to your happiness lies between your chakras and your bank account. And I thought, that's not a joke.
That's not
That's
a joke.
Actually the reality of living an artist's life.
100%. You start writing a song and you think it's about something, and then all of a sudden some strange twist happens and you're like, oh, this is what I'm talking about. This is one of those songs where I thought I was talking about first social media, and then it turned into this self-help world and this... And I'm like, wow, we are so tired of this.
Yeah. I can hear you talking about social media. For the most part, I can hear that the energy is making fun of this idea that you don't need to be happy. You just need to look happy
for
social media.
You need to look happy, 100%. And there's also this, I think, this sad joke, because in a way, there's a lot of pain in that of, do we really have to do this? Do we have to... In order to show vulnerability, do we have to strip ourselves? Do we have to show ourselves naked on Instagram? Do we have to do that? And I was very bothered by that.
Yeah.
And I was very bothered by seeing a younger generation, students, female students of mine, showing, like exposing themselves because they are somehow encouraged to do that. So they get more followers and they get more people on their TikTok or Instagram accounts. I was very bothered by that.
Yes.
And it found its way in the song, I guess. Yes, yeah.
But I do think that when I say that there is real truth in the idea that the key to happiness lies between the chakras and the bank account, it is how do we make work that we believe in that will also sustain us? Because it's wonderful to make work that we love for us only, but we also have to consider not only an audience, but like, how am I going to be able to do this again? And how will I support myself? And how will I survive? And that's why I felt like, no, there's real truth in that idea that somewhere between what I need for my heart and what I need for my stomach lies the truth.
It's a struggle. And it's the unsolvable puzzle.
Yeah.
Every day I think I found a way, yeah. Or maybe I can be okay with this. And then all of a sudden, I find myself again, pushed and pulled between this. Yeah, how do we exactly make this sustainable, yet something that I really believe in and something I'm passionate about? And how do I present the music that I want to create in the most direct and personal and authentic way? It's very hard.
You seem to be making music that could exist as pop music, but making it in the conditions of more of like a jazz or a new music artist. You got a grant for this record, 3 grants for this record.
3.
So you made it sort of outside of all of the sort of commercial business aspects that so many of us are chasing.
I actually believe this is the most pop album I have ever made.
Yeah.
And yet is not extremely commercial music. I understand that. But I think because of my background and because there is a way to create it that comes more from, a jazz mindset in a way. I guess it got the attention also because of the themes that we were proposing and the topics of the songs and the fact that there were music female creators involved. We got the support of the New York Foundation for the Arts, Women's Fund, and Chamber Music America's artistic projects and New Music USA. And I am so thankful for that because then I was able to create the kind of album that I wanted to make and pay the creators and the collaborators and everybody accordingly, because it's so difficult making albums, except for some folks like the Suno CEO who believes that is boring and for free. And
everybody can make an
everybody
album.
Everybody can make a record. Yeah. Yes, if you use Suno, for sure. But it's very labor intensive and it's very is expensive.
Yes.
There are, of course, so many folks involved in the whole process of recording and mixing and mastering and artwork and photographs. And
it's expensive in terms of time, because our time is worth something. And we
really
spend a lot of, I think, I'm trying to convince myself that it is.
That's true.
So it's expensive. I think, just to speak a little bit more about this idea of the pop, non-pop aspect of it, I think there's a real argument being made in your music and certainly on this record. But going back, I went back and watched your Tiny Desks, both of them, and I can see that this is a long time you've been making this argument, that the sounds, the tools that we associate with pop music can be used not just to make simple, obvious, formulaic music. You know, you can put an 808 on something and it doesn't mean that it's going to be a very basic repetitive thing. You can use it in very creative ways, but it signals in your brain sort of
2026.
Psychoacoustically, this is pop music. But then when you listen more deeply, it's walking this interesting line, I think.
I agree with you. I think I love jazz. I, again, spent the last 20 something years of my more listening to jazz, performing, being part of the jazz scene in New York, and so thankful for it. And I learned so much from it. But there was always, not in all projects, but in many of them, I was missing that other sonic freedom. Yeah. I mean, I grew up listening to both acoustic music, but also electronic music. And I was like, oh, wait, I'm craving for these other sounds that are just not present. And I started experimenting with very basic tools like delay pedals. I actually borrowed one of my guitar player friends. Okay, can I take this home? Yeah. Then I started buying them and then I started collecting them and I started doing quite a lot of stuff with loopers and effect processors. And that was my way into the creation of that.
Yeah.
But then I'm like, oh, this is what Massive Attack was using or whatever. All these artists that I was listening to growing up were doing, and you know, Bjork and people that I really love. And I think the problem is in the compartmentalization, right? And thinking, okay, jazz has to be acoustic and chamber music cannot have electronic components. And it's been happening for 60 years.
Yeah.
It's not that we are creating anything with this. Jazz already had experiments with electronic music since...
You could go all the way back. For example, like Max Roach would talk about how the drum set was actually a byproduct of technology. It was a way to unite all of these drums into a set.
Exactly.
And it required pedals. And that was a form of technology in the 20th century.
Technological innovation. Exactly. Yeah, I think... I don't know, there is a bit to blame in music school sometimes. Oh, you're in the jazz program, or you're in the classical music program, or in this and such program, or you play such and such instrument and that's it. Or you are a composer, or you are... And I always found trouble with that because I'm the kind of person that's like una todera.
Yeah, a little of everything.
A little bit of everything. Yeah. I write and I produce, and I'm not a wonderful piano player or charango player, but I do a bit of those to incorporate them to my music. And I always loved so many different styles of music. Yeah. And I find this is the best way that I can present what I'm hearing without judging too much. And honestly, I could not have made this album without JC.
Yeah.
Because JC Mellard, he's from the French Caribbean.
Yeah, tell me about him.
I'll tell you about him because he's wonderful and I think you should meet.
Yeah. I'm just discovering him now and watched him even on the Tiny Desk from 10 years ago. He's playing like a nylon string guitar.
A sus bass.
It's called a sus bass
and it's an instrument that was built for him based on a Turkish sus. And it has, the tuning is G, C, Sol, Do, Fa, Si bemol, F, B flat.
Yeah.
So the lowest string is like a third above the lowest string on a bass. Uh-huh. So it sounds like a bass, but it's double string. So he can play guitar and bass simultaneously, plucking down or up. And he does it so well.
I thought it was pedals that was getting, that
no.
he, it's that's the instrument itself.
It's the instrument itself and him, which I don't know how he manages that. But he's a multi-instrumentalist. We do a lot of stuff in duo settings also. And JC is from the French Caribbean, from Guadeloupe. He's one of the most eclectic musicians I know. And he was in the early times of world music in Paris.
Yeah.
He was there. He was playing with everybody. Yeah. He was producing or performing or writing for and with all these bands, with Angélique Kidjo and with everybody there, Etienne Mbappé. And I think that... He brings that and he brings his jazz background and the background of the traditional music from the French Caribbean and all of it. And he did not know anything about Latin music before. I mean, maybe listening, but he never played or participated in any project that was involved in Latin music before knowing me. And I love that because in a way it brings like a fresh perspective. And rhythmically, he's so sharp.
Yeah.
He understands. I'm like, oh, let's get into this Afro-Peruvian stuff and check it out. The cajon, you know, this is the pattern. This is what's happening. Let's check out. And immediately he understands it. And one beautiful thing about it also is that both of us felt that the rhythmic aspect of this music, the DNA needed to be honored. And it needed to be honored in a way of the way that the drummers are playing it, the nuance of it, the accents, the dynamics, all of that. Taking all that information from a particular drum and then, you know, using all that MIDI information to reshape that with other sonic elements that we found interesting. That was a lot of what was happening with Umbral and with this project. He's so brilliant. He has a really wonderful mind as an arranger also. I don't think this record would have existed without him, and we worked together so well. The one thing that was different for me is that this time I felt I got a lot more into production myself. I feel like I'm so far away from the tools he has, but I am closer and closer to be able to do it in the way that I'm hearing it in my head. You know, I think that's being able to translate that on your own, even if you work with, of course, great many other collaborators and producers, I think is fantastic. And that's exactly what I got out of it.
Yeah, I know over the years when I was really focused on producing other artists that it's a bit of a tension sometimes, because artists who have an idea in their head but don't have the wherewithal to execute themselves, they're working through somebody else. And there is a lot of space in there for disagreement, or even just a sense sometimes for me, like, I'm not here just to execute your vision. I'm here to bring something also. And over time, I came to the conclusion that it's better if you can do it yourself.
If
you
agree.
Can get closer to it. And yet, on top of all of the other incredible skills that you've had to study and work on, just the music, you and your voice to start with, and composition and being a person and all of this stuff, now here you are at this stage in your life and career going, now I've got to become a producer also.
It's crazy. Whenever you think you figured out a little bit of an instrument, then it just gets... But that's at this point, I think I'm okay with that. I always thought of myself as a singer primarily, and I think that's the one instrument that I have some sense of control over. But everything else, whoa, I don't know. I was never the kind of person that could spend 10 hours a day practicing one thing. My mind just wanders through so many places. But for a while now, I think that's something that I really want to focus on and really nurture and accomplish, because it became such an important aspect of my music that I know that I need those tools so that I can present it in the most direct way possible.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that I wouldn't work with JC or with other producers, because of course he brings so much to the table, but I can be very specific about what I'm hearing, what I like, and what tools to use for that.
Let's talk a little bit about teaching, because part of what you're describing is a lived experience that has brought you to this sort of understanding. Like even when you talk about the song with Gabi, where you say, why do you have to undress for the camera? Why does every... And also, that information that I think young artists are receiving, this is how you have to present yourself, leads to a kind of sameness in so many artists. And what you're, again, quietly arguing is, don't be the same. Be weird. Be different. Be surprising. Be unique.
I think I always thought the uniqueness and the originality aspect of whatever you bring, it was the most important thing. Yeah. I saw it for the past few years. That is not the focus of many young artists that I meet, which concerns me a little bit. But I think that is shifting right now because of AI. That's one good thing that might come out of it.
I agree.
Because for generic, I just go to Suno.
You can never be more generic than Suno.
Yeah.
And it's got that covered. I felt the same way.
And it's going to do it so much better.
Yeah, so much better than we will ever do.
In 1 second, I'm going to sound like a million bucks and I'm going to produce a pop song. So find the weirdest thing that you can propose to the world. Go for it, find it, and use it, because that's where it's at. And it was always there, but right now is so much more important.
Yes.
Because how will you bring your humanity to the table? Yeah. How will you bring anything new? We are inundated by sameness.
Yes.
What can you bring that's just... That's one thing I can be proud of, and I didn't think of it, but maybe if nobody listens to this record, but at least I know it's something different.
Yeah.
And just different.
I mean, this is what's so interesting. You managed to reveal so much of your own humanity through a record that has a lot of electronic element in it, which goes to show you that the tools are, they're agnostic.
The tools are agnostic. I remember Bjork talking about that, and I was like, yes, girl. She's like, oh, the computer, who cares? There is a human behind it that's exactly bringing her entire humanity through it. And that's very true. I'm so thankful that I got to work at this place, at the Clive Davis Institute, because I think it made me face my own biases against pop music, for instance. Again, we are so formatted. We don't even realize how formatted we are.
You came here to New England School of NEC.
The New England Conservatory, which was very open-minded and artsy, but very jazz, like hardcore and free jazz and very innovative. But we were formatted for Jazz Planet.
Yes.
And there was a lot, even though everybody was pretty open-minded and everything. And I think these environments shape your way of thinking of other styles of music.
Sure.
And there was a lot of pushback. And then I started discovering the music my students were listening to. And I really had to open my ears.
Yeah.
And pay attention and find what was appealing to them so that I could help them create the best music they could and perform. I really liked that they were more focused on the storyline, in the narrative, in the content, in terms of emotional content and poetic content, than the technical aspect of it, which we were so concerned with. And I was like, wow, this is good. This is one good thing about this new generation. I hope that they can find a way to bring this other side to, you know, to the table as well. And that's what I try to help them
I
with.
See.
But it was an eye-opener for me. And I think it influenced quite a lot also my own music, because even though I was listening to pop forever, it was even more so these past many years because of being there. And I think it influenced my own records. But the classes that I teach, well, I do all kinds of things there. But every semester, I teach a performance class, which is so interesting, so fascinating. Because when I was a student, for us, it was much easier to stand out there and perform a song than to record a song. But for most of my students, it's much easier to record a song from one day to another than to get in front of their classmates and perform. So I help them navigate that, and I help them bring their produced songs to something that would work in a performance setting, right? So it's really cool, and they're so talented. And
So they'll bring you a recording?
So they will bring a song of theirs. Most of them are singer-songwriter producers.
Yeah.
And I help them with stage presence, repertoire, body awareness, arrangements for live performance, all kinds of things. It's very broad, which I love because I can...
You are very broad.
I'm broad.
Yeah.
I'm not very specific. I'm broad.
Yeah.
So it's great. A vocal technique, of course, something that I can bring to the table, but it's been one of my favorite classes. And then I teach music theory and ear training. And I teach two classes that I put together, the contemporary Latin American music class and another class that's very me. That's a class that marries vocal improvisation with technological tools for live performance as a vocalist. So loopers
looping,
and effect processors. It's called the Creative Voice. So it's super fun. And I bring folks that also bring their own perspective of what they're doing, like Theo Bleckman.
I was just about to ask you about Theo, literally just about to ask you if you brought Theo in.
See, of course, two times.
Yeah.
Oh, students love Theo. I love Theo. He's phenomenal. They want to incorporate more of that in their live toolkit, right? I learned, now I was in sabbatical for a whole year. I'm going back in September. And it's going to be really cool because I feel I have a lot to tell him about the world I saw, right? Throughout this whole year, releasing a new album, traveling all around and creating a new project that will be like a journalistic opera. I think I will be able to help them better. And I will also be getting some new feedback and information from them. Yeah.
I want to talk about the journalistic opera, but before we do, so I have a friend who I was just talking to the other day, who is now 27 or 28, incredible young female singer-songwriter who, when I met her, was like 19 maybe. And she, since I met her, got a record deal and a booking agent and a publisher, and has been dropped from her record deal and has lost her manager and is going through what looks like, I guess you would call, a quarter life crisis. And as I was talking to her, one of the things I found myself saying was, it is so awful that urgency was placed on you, that your success was attached to youth, and that there was some kind of a schedule. Obviously, popular music is the music of the young, so there's always going to be an aspect of that. But what I did say to her was, but here's the good news. You no longer have to compete with 19-year-olds because you're not 19. Now you have the patience of the rest of your life to figure out what is your career going to look like, because it's not going to be that. That's already happened. Mm-hmm. It's over. And now you have a lot of time. You know, you can't be lazy, but like you don't have to be on anybody's schedule anymore other than your own schedule. Your faced with these highly ambitious, highly talented young artists who I'm sure all of them are hoping to find some degree of success as quickly as possible. You didn't get here until, you know, a certain age. And then I think we're about the same age. And then you went to NEC and then you came here and then had to set it up. And it's 20 years of being in New York. And that's a career.
We talk about that quite a lot. And it's something that with my colleagues, we talk about quite a lot. It's, I think that's the hardest thing to understand when you are 18, 19, 20, 21 in a program like this also that's more in a pop environment, to understand that you build this for the rest of your life and that is so hard to make it sustainable for 20, 30 years to bring something new every time that you create a record, which you know so well because you've done it yourself. And it's just, it's not about the viral moment. And you can have a viral moment. Even if you go for that, you can have the viral moment. You can have the viral TikTok. And then a month later, nobody cares for you or your music. I think the mindset needs to be in sustainability, in doing what you feel that's right. And in terms of presenting yourself in an authentic way or the most authentic way possible and sustaining that over the years. It's so hard. Building a team, building your own team if you can. And ambition is really hard to avoid because, of course, but let's build a body of work. Let's have the songs and let's work on the type of artist that you want to be before thinking so much, although it's hard to avoid, on the marketing and the success markers that we are all told we should be looking at.
Yes.
I think we are going through an interesting change right now in the music industry because I don't think these markers are as important anymore.
Yeah.
I think everywhere we see this of like, oh, such and such artist did not sell tickets in Seattle where he or she were supposed to have 1,000 million followers on Spotify and I don't know how many on TikTok and Instagram. And all these metrics are just not translating into real fans.
Yes.
I could be followed on Instagram because I'm funny. Now we're seeing that numbers are not the whole picture. I think you can have a very successful career, quote unquote career in music without having the million fans and the super viral videos or TikTok content. If some folks that really like whatever you do show up consistently and you show up consistently for them.
This relationship between you and your students, does it make it easier for you to want to show up as an artist or does it make it harder for you to want to show up as an artist? It's a lot of your own heart and soul that you have to put into your students that you take away from yourself. Are you inspired by your students?
I am very inspired by my students. It's both because I'm very inspired by my students. I see their creativity. I appreciate it. I see creative ways also for them to put out their own music. And I hear their influences. I'm interested in all that. But of course, to be a full-time professor in a music school like this, of course, in terms of energy, in terms of as many hours of the day that you can have to, of course, to that's definitely a reality as well. The whole balancing act is always very precious and it's very delicate. And there are moments of the year when one gives way to the other, of course. And I can definitely see how they feed from each other, but it's also hard to balance everything for sure.
So you have a lot of projects. We were talking about this record, but you know, you also, you have projects where you're really leaning into the vocal aspect of what you do. You're doing duos with Jorge?
Yes. So Jorge Roder, phenomenal bass player. He's from Peru, but he's been here in the U.S. since 2002. We met at the New England Conservatory in 2002 in a hallway. He tapped my shoulder. I was like, hey, everybody told me that I need to meet you because you are the older South American in the program.
Oh, he wanted you to know.
I'm like, okay, let's get together. Let's play some music. And we did. And I was like, okay, that's it. We started playing together in 2002. So it's a it's my longest collaborator, really.
Wow.
And he's, over the years, we started doing some some things as a duet. And then in 2020 and in 2023, I think we released a duo record called Coplas Escondidas, Hidden Tales. That was repertoire that we put together over 20 years.
Yeah.
And finally, during the pandemic, we're like, okay, we're ready. Yeah. We have time now in our hands. Let's do it. We toured in Japan and Europe and a little bit in the US. And now he literally called me last week and he's like, do you want to come to Lima? Let's go to Lima. Next week, we're going to Lima. We have a show and we're doing a masterclass and we're doing this vinyl record thing. I'm like, sure.
Wow.
What's not to like? Let's go to Lima. So next week, literally, we're going to Lima. So with Jorge and with this duo, we are always, it's seasons of shows. And we did, this year, our last tour was in Europe. It was great. It was super fun. And it's the easiest project in terms of the production. It's just me, a microphone, and a toothbrush. That's it. Sometimes I play charango, but it's so simple. The sound check for Saturday is a 15-minute line check. And I was like, we can okay that. It's fine. Yeah. We can manage with all my other projects. It's like,
no
way. Give me 3 hours, please, because maybe we don't even make it with that. So, yes, wow. We have that. I have, of course, this project that, in terms of the live aspect, can go from, me and JC performing as a duo to the extended format with the whole band and multiple guests, the way that we presented it at National Sawdust a couple of months ago and LPR last year. And also, I am doing a project that I'm really excited about. And I am so new to this planet, but I hope that we can managed to put it together. It's, I don't know if to call it a journalistic opera, but is in collaboration with a journalist that's NPR's correspondent for immigration right now, Jasmine Gars. And she's been working as the main correspondent reporting on ICE raids all throughout the country since the second Trump administration. And it's a story of three Guatemalan women. The grandmother moves to Nebraska in the early 90s, escaping the civil war in Guatemala. And she finds herself working in a meat factory there, a meat factory town in Fremont, Nebraska. Her daughter is able to also move to the state. And she starts also working in the factory, but her dream is to have her own business. And she creates this bar, restaurant, that my friend stumbles upon when she goes there to cover these raids. The piece is based on the story of this restaurant bar called Reinitas, Little Queens. And it tells the story of this three also her, the daughter, the grandmother, the mother, the granddaughter, and how this whole community has been affected by the immigration crackdowns. So,
and are you writing the music and
I'm
the book?
I'm writing the music. She's writing the book.
Yeah.
My friend. And we are using quite a lot of archival footage, and we're also creating our own archive with video interviews of family members interviewing each other. So it's going to be, it's a very ambitious project.
Yes.
And it's a multimedia project.
Yes.
We are super excited about it, and we got two beautiful grants to support it. So we're very excited.
Did you ever see Mobro, John Ellis's project about a barge?
No.
That's a project that he wrote.
Mobro.
Yeah. He did it at Jazz Gallery last year, but it was written maybe 10 years ago. A bunch of singers and music. And he didn't write the book, the libretto,
the script,
or whatever,
yeah.
But he did set it to music. And it's not multimedia, but it does seem like it might be something to check out.
Nice.
It's in that
world. He used to live in the apartment where I live now.
In the same unit.
Same unit.
You are not. Now, he would argue that's not the dorms, but it's related to the dorm. It's
The Jazz dorms are on Ocean Avenue. Yeah. I live on Flatbush Avenue they call it the Jazz Dorms 2.0.
Yeah.
It's just like the apartments are slightly bigger.
Yeah.
That's it. That's all it is. But there are so many artists, so many jazz musicians living in my tower and in the tower across the street.
I always wanted to do a piece about that. I know the New York Times did something years ago about it, but I really think that when you talk about what it is to be a musician, a jazz musician, or just an artist of any kind in New York, understanding the real estate reality is a big part of it. And I thought, what would happen if those buildings weren't there? How many musicians would have not had a stable place to live for a long time?
100%. 100%. No, we got so lucky now with the rent freeze.
Oh,
because
good.
Most of the apartments on that building, and same with Jazz dorms, are rent stabilized.
Yeah. That's heavy stuff. Do you talk to your students about that stuff? About, do they know about the reality of rent in New York?
No, I don't think so. I mean, some of them are facing it after their sophomore year because they have to move away from the dorms and find a place to live with other, you
people,
know,
friends
and figure it out. But I think for the most part, they are supported by their families until they finish their degree. And then I think that that's when it really hits. Oh, okay. I'm out of school. And
this is my job.
And I need a job. Yeah. And I need to find. Yeah. I think that's something very complicated about New York. On the one hand, it's such a precious, wonderful place to be if you're an artist because of the music scene, because of the creativity, because of the energy that the city brings to everyday life. But at the same time, it could be a trap because you can find yourself working all day just to support yourself so you can even think of existing as an artist. So it's so hard.
I know.
It's so difficult.
I know. I don't know what the answer is. And so many artists actually, when they become established enough, whatever that means, do leave. They move upstate or they go somewhere simpler and quieter because they don't necessarily need the access. It's so seductive though also, and it becomes a little bit of an addiction to be around the energy and feel like you, if you're not here, then you're. But you know, you mentioned this, the journalistic opera. What has it been like for you in the last couple of years? Just as a, you're from Argentina, there's a huge, within the Trump administration, conflation and confusion about where people are from and what it means. Have you felt unsafe? Have you felt uncomfortable? Have you reconsidered being in this country?
It's a really good question. I, even before this, the last Trump administration started, I started feeling more and more conflicted about being here because of the what it means to be in a country that it, in terms of its, even in terms of its foreign policy, I'm so in disagreement with.
Yes.
And so it started being like really heavy on me. Wow. I come from Argentina. I grew up during the last dictatorship and the last dictatorship was sponsored by the United States. I'm like, wow, how can I move to the mouth of the ogre in a way? And I always found myself excusing this by being like, but I'm in New York. New York is different.
It's not really America.
It's not really America. It's different. And but it started to shift in a way, and it started to feel even more heavy during the second Trump administration, where I'm like, why? I'm here. I'm somehow supporting this by being here. And I think because of that, my projects have become more and more political and more interested in showing and in that this change or these possibilities or these ideas can be different. And I, in showing an issue, such a pressing issue as it is, the immigration crackdown, so many families that are being separated and so many people suffering because of these policies. And to be honest, also a terrible idea in terms of economics and everything else that we can talk about. But I don't know. I feel that at least in this way, I can feel contributing to something that I believe in and I think is powerful. In the music that I make, having a narrative that feels important to me and that is political and that talks about issues that I feel are very pressing. So I think it had a lot to do with this feeling of more and more being uncomfortable with this situation.
Yeah, I think it is a question in terms of, and I remember going back to, you know, when you walked through the door, you mentioned our mutual friend, Alexis Cuadrado. And so actually so much of what you've discussed and mentioned today reminds me of things that I've talked about with him. But I remember during the first Trump presidency, he said, I am dedicating my work to protest. Ryan Keberle also, when we had our conversation during the first Trump presidency, he said, I am making protest music. Everything that I do is a form of protest, even if it's just asserting the freedom that exists within the music that we make. That's a music that is built around freedom and expression. that is a form of protest, if nothing else. Just collectively improvising is a form of
protest. Absolutely. Just the music that we make is a form of protest.
Yeah.
I agree. Yes.
And yet there is this question of, well, does there need to be a mission behind what we're doing? I think so many of us are confronting this. I'm just finishing another record right now. It's maybe my most personal record I've ever made. And for a while, I struggled thinking, how am I, in the face of all of this, making a record that's about me and my feelings when it should be about something bigger? And then I thought, well, you know what? Each of us is a human being. And so I'm going to reach into my own human experience.
Yes.
And that's what I have to talk about right now.
Yes.
But I do think that becomes the question, is, are we failing as public servants in some way? Because I think art, being an artist, is a form of public service.
I agree. I mean, I always been very interested in politics, in what's happening in society, what's happening.
Yeah.
But right now, it feels almost unavoidable for me to go into this direction. But I understand, just to be able to create the music that feels the most urgent for you, that's a form of protest.
Yeah.
And it's, and because I know the music that you make is fantastic, by the way.
Thank you so much.
I think it is such a statement that you can create something in the same way we were talking about, making it the most precious, the most human, the most anti-conform, AI slob.
Yeah.
And I think that that's vital, that's very important, and you should not question that. I think that's great.
But here you are, again, I guess this was the response to the question of how has this period in American history affected you, and if you've felt unsafe or uncomfortable, and I hear that you're grappling with it. But I also understand this thing about New York is not America. And there's this other piece of it, which is like, by just continuing to do what we do, it's possible we're turning our face away, closing our eyes to the reality of it, that we should all stop making music and we should all just be standing on the border or like protesting ICE raids. And that should be our job. We forget music. We need to get politically involved. Sometimes I think that, you know, I think that it's pointless to make music in the face of such danger, real danger. And then I think, first of all, each of us is going to contribute what we know how to contribute and what we can contribute.
Right.
And also, maybe it is important. You know, maybe it's one of the most important things that we can do is keep the arts alive.
I think if Jasmine and I finish this work and we are able to show what we want to say about how badass is that these women did what they did, and how badass this community, how resilient this community is, and how amazing what they've achieved, and how important it is for so many folks to see that, maybe that was more of a contribution than me just as a sole individual going to a protest, going to a march.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that's not crucial.
Yes.
Both are important, but perhaps it has more of a reach. Perhaps it has. We all know how powerful it can be.
Yeah.
It's just a song, right? Maybe just one song that, I don't know, it moves 100 people.
Yeah.
I'm not going to say, you know,
a million people.
Exactly. But like just 100 people that were sitting in a theater or in multiple locations or whatever, that were moved by a song and that changed their mind or made them think differently about a situation or a community. I think that's very powerful. And that's my hope. I don't know if that's going to happen, but that's my hope. And I hope it happens in that way. Let's see.
Sophia, I have to tell you that I said the same thing to Theo Blechman when I interviewed him. It happens to me sometimes. It's been so long that I've been waiting to talk to you that I let it go too long because I started to get worried that I wasn't going to be able to cover or speak fully to all that you do, because you're very accomplished and it's so impressive and a little intimidating. But of course, like Theo, you're not intimidating at all. You're very fun to be with and approachable and cool, and we should be friends. And
I want to be your friend. Yeah, can I be your friend?
Yeah, let's be friends.
I mean, I really admire what you've done, and it's so phenomenal. And again, we have, for a long time, I wanted to meet you, and now we managed.
Now we did it.
So we'll do it again.
I want to ask you one final question. Normally, I like to arrive somewhere. This doesn't doesn't arrive anywhere. It's just a funny thing I discovered in preparing to talk to you. I never saw it originally, but sometime in the past, you were sitting in your window. I think you must have lived in Manhattan at the time.
Yes.
And drinking a mate and watching the scene on the street. And Conan O'Brien was filming a TV show.
How did you find that?
And he like fell in love with you for a minute.
So it was exactly like that. I was...
Was it in the East Village?
I was living in the Greenwich Village on Downing Street. Uh-huh. My boyfriend at the time left the day before, and he was a smoker, so he would always bring out the screen of the window, and it was all open.
Yeah,
I was just talking to my sister on the phone when I see this very tall, red-haired man. I'm like, and I'm telling my sister, I think Conan O'Brien is right in front of my house right now. She's like, Conan who? She's from Argentina. Yeah. She has no clue. He sees that and he heard me speaking in Spanish on the phone. He's like, hola. He starts talking to me. So I dropped the phone and I was drinking mate and I started having a conversation with him that was much longer than what is on that clip. Yeah. But we had a ball. Yeah. It was so fun.
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah. So do you want to? He's like, do you want to get some Chinese food? I'm like, no, I'm drinking mate. You want some mate? No. You know, like I'll show him how to drink it. Yeah. And then we were talking about all kinds of things. And he's like, oh, you're like a dream. I'm coming back. Let's hang out. And it was such a fun conversation that's very spontaneous. I was like, very non-intimidating. And there were these cameras. I don't know. It was just talking to this guy for 15 minutes.
Wow.
He leaves. And a crew comes right after. And he's like, oh, can you sign this release and whatnot? And I'm like, sure. And then I kind of forgot about it. And a few months passed by. And a friend of mine from Argentina is like, I just saw you on TV on Conan O'Brien. I'm like, what? And then everybody starts calling me like, oh, I just saw you on. And then most of my friends were like, well, how come you didn't sing a song?
Yeah.
And, and I'm like, no, it was not about that. We were just talking, you know, he just showed up. He's so funny.
I think that's interesting. And I think that was my takeaway from seeing it also. It's so easy to get attached to this work that we do and this thing that we do. And we are the work that we make and all of that. And Conan didn't know anything about that. He just talked to you and you just talked to him. And there was something fundamental, essential about you in that moment that wasn't about being a singer. It was just about being you.
Yeah. That was really nice. And it was a one very fun moment that keeps, I don't know, every couple of years, somebody brings it up. And it's like, was it you?
Yeah.
And everybody thinks that it happened because I'm a musician. Yeah. And then and it was exactly the opposite. It was he just found the opportunity to talk to somebody and it became a fun conversation.
So you just never know. I mean, maybe the takeaway there is the work that we do prepares us to accept the moment, to say yes to the whatever happens to us.
That's true.
Maybe, I don't know.
So how did you find the clip?
I was just looking into you before you came over looking for stuff, and that was one of the things I found.
That's so funny. Yeah.
Sofia Rey, what a pleasure. Congratulations on this wonderful record.
Thank you so much, and it's been really a pleasure to talk to you today. Muchas gracias.
There she was, my friends, Sofia Rey. What a beautiful person. What a beautiful soul. What a great talk. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it. Until then, hablamos pronto.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.